Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Drought and plagues, these are two scenarios that come to mind when you talk about water shortages, climate change, and disrupted ecosystems. These pose big questions around human values, economic adaptation, and survival. That's why the University of Lethbridge has formed WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. Two scientists involved with WISE are Dr. Stuart Rood and Dr. Dan Johnson. One studies rivers and the other grasshoppers. Their research will help us develop better practices to manage our water and our land in challenging times. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Lethbridge sits in the heart of irrigation country. Agriculture there is dependent on dams and diversions to bring water to an otherwise parched landscape. But things are changing. Drought, climate change, and human encroachment are all contributing to increasing water shortages, and new ways must be found to manage our water resources. Dr. Stuart Rood is a professor of environmental science at the University of Lethbridge and a participant in WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems.
Relative to previous water shortages, as we go through the last century in Alberta, the solution to a water shortage was to build a dam to allow for the storage of spring runoff, and that water was then released through the summer during the hot, dry period. That solution won't work anymore, and the reason is that all of the rivers in the South Saskatchewan Basin have now been dammed. So we have a situation in which we have a finite resource in terms of the water availability. We have limitations in terms of our management opportunity, and the prior solution of supply management by damming and diversion has basically been completed. So as we move into the new millennium, we have to think about the alternate solution to the water shortage, which is conservation of this limited resource. We've heard about interbasin transfers. As we think about the central part of the province that tends to be wetter and the rivers are larger, some would argue that this is an abundant water source that could be diverted southward. There are two possible problems with this. Number one is the ecological problem. Anytime you have a large-scale change in the water flow, you have large-scale impacts on all of the systems that are functioning on that. And the second problem is that in the future, if in fact the climate becomes more commonly dry, the central part of Alberta will experience conditions like this year more commonly. And so it will be the case that Red Deer and Edmonton and the regions in that area will require their own rivers for their own solution of their water shortages. So the interbasin transfer strategy may in fact be a short-term one that in the long term is exactly the wrong thing to do.
A new water institute has been set up out of the University of Lethbridge. What will be your part in this?
The Water Institute of Semi-Arid Ecosystems, that is a partnership between a number of academic and government and private institutions centered out of southern Alberta, but more broadly interacting with other parts of Alberta and other adjacent and even distant jurisdictions. The intent of this organization is to better understand the processes that relate to water quantity and quality and look for innovative solutions, innovative strategies for dealing with future challenges. My particular role is as a fundamental research scientist. I particularly study river systems, and we're interested in how much water rivers require to maintain their function and how the function of the river provides us with the various values that humans not only enjoy and appreciate, but in fact rely on economically as well. So I'm interested in how much water do we have to leave in the river system to allow for the values that these rivers provide us in Alberta?
You've been looking at these issues for a number of years. What are some of the things that you know now from the work that you have done about how the systems here work?
It's been an exciting time to be researching rivers in Alberta, and particularly the period in the late 1980s and early 1990s with the controversy surrounding the Old Man River Dam. This was a national precedent relative to environmental resource management. For the first time, environmental impact was recognized as a serious concern relative to a major river management project in Canada. The particular case had a number of precedent-setting aspects. Jurisdiction, is it provincial or federal, and why? Relative to that particular question, legal rulings were requested. They went up to the level of Supreme Court, and the rulings were clear that rivers are not only local, they're not only provincial, but clearly they're federal as well, because they cross boundaries, they cross provinces, and they also affect aspects that are federal in nature, fisheries, navigation, Native American issues, and other federal aspects. And so with the Old Man River Dam project, there was to some extent a change in the tide relative to perception and perspective on the values of rivers and the vulnerability of rivers. Prior to that study in Alberta, if one was contemplating a dam or diversion, one would undertake technical studies largely related to hydrology, stability of the system, and making sure that, you know, the dam would not fail. So these were geotechnical assessments. But the broader environmental and social and even cultural impacts were relatively neglected. Now we understand that those impacts are substantial, and they have to be seriously considered in any possible water management project.
What would be some of those? What have you found?
Relative to environmental impacts, what we're understanding is that there is an interconnectedness of water and all of the aspects and organisms reliant on water. As we change water flow, we influence water temperature, we influence water chemistry. These influence fish, of course, but they also influence aspects of water quality that in turn relates to the suitability for human use and human safety. For example, if we think about the combination of clearing our floodplain zones to provide fields for production of livestock, and if we combine that with reducing stream flows, we create conditions in which the fecal coliform bacteria proliferate, and this leads to problems relative to human water quality, not only for drinking, but also for contact. And so what we're doing is we're creating hazards and toxic zones from what should be one of our proudest resources in Alberta.
What does the weather have to do with some of the problems we're experiencing now with water shortages? And then also, there are so many people that live down here. Certainly that has an impact as well.
Ultimately, weather provides the origin for the water that flows along our streams and recharges our groundwater. Consequently, we are really at the mercy of weather patterns with respect to the water balances that we face. With respect to the future, independent of the projections about climate change, we know that there will be wet periods and dry periods. Relative to this, it's inappropriate to do water budgeting or modeling based on average years, because half of the years are drier than average. And in fact, a certain proportion naturally are much drier than average. The business of climate change is indeed something that we should pay attention to. The science is uncertain, but just as we could be underestimating or overestimating aspects of temperature, we may be under or overestimating aspects of precipitation. And the modeling is incomplete relative to temperature, but even less complete relative to precipitation. There was a recent study conducted by my colleague Jim Byrne, who concluded that if we apply some of the large global circulation models, and if we anticipate the types of carbon dioxide accumulations that have been occurring over the past number of decades, what might happen is that in southern Alberta, we actually get more winter precipitation that's rain instead of snow. Now, this is a problem relative to the irrigation infrastructure, because it's the snowmelt that is most effectively utilized in the subsequent irrigation project. If we have just a few degrees difference in the winter, Then rather than providing the snow accumulation in November or December, we have rain events, again, that have a different, very different pattern relative to infiltration and runoff, et cetera. So weather is a great mystery. It's something we all like to talk about, but we're not very good at predicting it, and we're certainly at the mercy of it.
What is it that you see that needs to be done or that you want to do to incorporate into your research program that would contribute to the Water Institute and the work that it's going to do?
Lethbridge is ideally situated to conduct the types of studies that my group investigates, and that is, how are the changes in land use, in water allocation, diversion, and management, how do these factors influence environmental processes that ultimately have values for social and economic human uses? Lethbridge is located in a region in short order and fairly in perhaps a couple of hours. We can go from the border of Waterton Glacier and BC that has western red cedar, a tree that requires almost a rainforest type of precipitation regime. We can go in the opposite direction from Lethbridge to the east into the Badland Zone, where we have a landscape dominated by cacti and sagebrush and other very xeric plants. And so what we're able to do is to compare impacts on different ecosystems as a result of changing water regimes. Generally speaking, our conclusion at this point is that systems that are already on the verge of collapse are likely to be especially vulnerable. That is to say, the regions that are already dry, the regions that are already at ecosystem transitions, are going to be the ones that are particularly impacted either by climate change or by increased water diversion. Locally, for example, if we think about the Calgary area, Calgary is really right on a transition from the Aspen Parkland to the prairie. And it would only take a very small change in the moisture balance to have the prairie move slightly to the west and north, or conversely to have the Aspen Parkland move to the south and east. And so it's interesting to look at these interface zones. It's a bit like the canary in the mine in that these interface zones are particularly sensitive to environmental change.
Environmental change on its own, under a natural cycle, there's not too much we can do about that, but what we deal with on a day-to-day basis is the human manipulation of the environment. What challenges do you see there for the water situation here?
One of the strengths of the approach undertaken by WISE is to combine not only natural science and physical science, but also looking at social science, including economics. And we have to ask ourselves, what are the values of the various products that are reliant on water? For example, during the drought of this summer, and particularly last summer in Calgary, residents were advised not to water their lawns and not to water their gardens. One might reply to that, I'd be willing to pay a certain amount of money to have a little bit of green space around my house, just as I'm willing to repaint the exterior, and it's largely an aesthetic type of alteration. One might alternately consider that just as I can go to the store and spend $10 for a T-bone steak, I could alternately spend the $10 on an equivalent amount of water, which would actually be quite a bit in terms of the forage production for livestock production for feedlot type of cattle. I can alternately decide to use that money to buy water to allow for my green lawn or my gardens that are thriving. Unfortunately, the present water pricing doesn't reflect the actual cost of the water itself or, in fact, the true delivery value. We have all kinds of complexities in terms of subsidies and complex government-sponsored programs. The whole infrastructure of irrigation is a very complex network that is largely dependent on past government subsidy. And it is absolutely certain that irrigation provides an economic engine for parts of southern Alberta, but it's also equally certain that there are wastes of water associated with irrigation, just as there are wastes of water associated with every other practice. So what we need to do and what WISE is attempting to do is not only understand the science of water, but also understand the economics of water and the alternatives that we face.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Stuart Rood, a professor of environmental science at the University of Lethbridge. He's involved with WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems, and he's also a co-director of the newly established Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Water Research. Whether it's stories from the Bible or tales from the Great Depression, drought is coupled with plagues of locusts or grasshoppers. Over the last few years, significant parts of Alberta have experienced severe droughts and increasing infestations of grasshoppers. Dr. Dan Johnson is a grasshopper expert and research scientist with Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada at the Lethbridge Research Station. I spoke to him about how his research on grasshoppers ties in with the work at WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems.
Well, the particular project on grasshoppers and climate is an attempt to forecast into the future farther than we would normally forecast. Usually we're only 1 year in advance. It's an attempt to look forward and say, well, if we do have warmer, drier springs, for example, or if we have milder winters, what will be the impact? Now, the general impact, I know, and actually people like me, my predecessors in the grasshopper research positions, have known that we will have larger numbers of grasshoppers in general, but that's not enough of an answer. We need to know which species, when, and to what extent, because these things change a great deal between droughts, between outbreaks, and sometimes we have grasshoppers when we don't have droughts, and so on. So I'm looking at, for years now, the impact of weather on their life cycle, survival, reproduction, movement, feeding, and how the different species of hoppers are benefited or disadvantaged by certain kinds of weather, and forecasting that forward. Now, a lot of that's based on water, and that's why it fits into WISE.
What are some of the things that you've found so far?
Well, grasshoppers have been here with us for a long, long time. As I mentioned, almost since the ice receded thousands of years ago and the grassland returned, and they're very well adapted to semi-arid conditions, and they're well adapted to taking advantage of drought situations. Fortunately, our droughts are usually only 2 or 3 years long. In the past, they may have been 10 or 15 years long, and some of the grasshoppers are probably adapted to that as well. There are many different kinds. But some of them have the ability to increase their numbers hundreds of times per year, but normally they don't because they suffer from various diseases or weather conditions and so on. If some of those are removed, their ability to increase rapidly will be enhanced, and I'm identifying which species will do that. And for some it's very clear, and for others it's going to take a lot of experimentation and some modeling.
How would you experiment or model? What would you do?
Well, some of the questions are easy to answer with little simple equations regarding their reproductive budgets or their heat budgets and that sort of thing. Others require experiments. A simple one we did years ago that answered a question that was on people's minds was, when we have a year with floods, like this year early in the spring, how does that affect grasshopper eggs? Well, it's high school science to find out. Once you know which species you're dealing with, you immerse them for different times and hatch them out. It turns out it has almost no impact at all on their survival. They're not killed by it, but it slows them down. So then we calculate how much, how latent heat in the soil, wet or dry, affects them, and how these affect their natural enemies and so on. So a lot of it's experimentation, which is then translated into simple mathematical models, which we then expand to the region and go out and test and find out if these things really work the way we think or not. Sometimes we get big surprises. In 2002, although I knew, obviously, that grasshoppers have been increasing again since about 1999, and I've been waving my arms over this and making people tired of it, I think. But I was surprised in 2002 to see that one of our main species of hoppers just didn't even make a showing. Now, that species has a little bit different relationship to moisture, and it could increase in numbers following the drought. And that was the most common hopper in the past, the lesser migratory grasshopper. So we do have a number of changes, and we have to look forward and predict those.
What are the things that you're scratching your head over right now?
Well, a lot of things are largely unknown, even though I suspect they have big impacts. Tridanic recently finished his PhD here working on flies that kill grasshoppers. A lot of people don't realize so many flies kill grasshoppers. Some kill the eggs. Some directly attack the living grasshoppers, even the adults, and put maggots into them. We don't know to what extent. We don't know how they're affected by weather. Sometimes they help us enormously. Other times they're insignificant. We can't understand disease very well. People have studied fungi that attack grasshoppers for over a century now. And yet, occasionally I'll find a new pathotype that kills a species that was never killed before. Occasionally we'll find conditions in which a disease works very well and shouldn't. We'll find conditions in which the disease ought to work, and there's even inoculum, and yet it doesn't. So the problem with nature is that it resists our ability to treat it like an engineering system, and it has a lot of variables, and those have to be researched. Now, I'm optimistic, and I enjoy it, and I put in a lot of time, but I have to admit that these things aren't going to be answered very quickly. There's really very little research effort overall going into these questions, so these really are long-term questions.
Is there any concern that we might end up in the future with continuous plagues of grasshoppers? Just the way in biblical times they talked about plagues of locusts?
Well, I have no doubt that if the climate change scenarios are right, and I don't even mean the long-term ones to 2050 or later. I mean even looking at the trends over the next 10 years. Even if we set aside for a moment the debate over greenhouse gases, even if we look at the trends we've been having lately, we know a few things. We know that we will probably have years with very long and very intense grasshopper outbreaks. It's not a thing of the past. For example, in East Central Alberta, it was the worst in 40 years, or maybe even the worst since 1939 or 1933 or 1923. Those were all big grasshopper years, and in different parts of the prairies, we had different peaks. Overall, maybe this in 2002 was only the worst in 15 years, but for a particular farm, it may be the worst ever experienced by European agriculture at all. So we have to identify those spots, find out why that is, and then look forward. And I can tell you that we will have some years in the future with very long and very intense outbreaks, but I don't think they're going to be continuous, no. But it might seem that way to somebody who can't survive 3 or 4 years of grasshoppers. So we have to not just look forward and find out whether we will have them, but also to have some tools ready. Because a lot of our insecticides will slowly, I think, be lost because of environmental or health concerns or improvements in technology or perhaps questions regarding wildlife and urban encroachment and all these sorts of things. I mean, we will not have the same set of tools in the future that we have now. Things have changed all along. I mean, originally they were using arsenic. And then they were trying cyanide, you know, and then they were trying organochlorine insecticides and on and on. And we're improving, certainly. But the only thing we know is that the tools will change and we have to be ready. So we're working on alternative methods of control as well. But as you can imagine, there are too many questions and too few people. So these are going slowly and I'm concerned. I'm concerned. We need to train people. We need to get some answers. We can't just keep fighting fires.
Well, I suppose from a human perspective, we don't like grasshopper outbreaks because they affect crops. But from Mother Nature's point of view, if they keep coming back and they keep outsmarting all the things that we throw at them, there must be a reason for them to be in the ecosystem.
Well, the reason is the same for any species, and that is its own survival. And these things change over time, too. It's really quite remarkable. But the Rocky Mountain locust lived in North America for thousands of years and went extinct, possibly because of something we did. at the turn of the century. The last one was collected in Canada in 1902. So we have a totally different ballgame now with different players. And in future, we might have invasions from outside of new species. We might have flare-ups of some that aren't pests right now. In fact, I know two that will do that. Two out of the 80 species we have, most of which are harmless. So things change, and they change a great deal. And there is no balance and nominal condition of ecosystems that we can rely on to be there for us and a benevolent Mother Nature. It makes it very, very interesting. But grasshopper outbreaks in the past have actually trashed the environment in some years, much like the bison would sometimes trash the environment and then come back years later, presumably when it had regrown. We may be able to live with that in certain circumstances. We really can't in modern agriculture. And in fact, in cases where it's causing soil erosion, we can't really live with that and live with the legacy of lost soil because of an insect outbreak. So these sorts of issues are sometimes much bigger than control at the farm level, and they need some addressing. It's a good thing to think about.
What's happening in other areas of the world that have similar climates and soil and water conditions?
Well, many other areas in the world do have arid or semi-arid insects that erupt like this from time to time. Some are always endemic at some low numbers or moderate. We have that problem, too, with some. We also have some that are strongly affected by moisture and not pests, and this is something to be aware of. Some of them are very beneficial to birds and so on. Nutrient cycling, they play a big role in ecosystems. They're large players. But in many continents, the whole question of grasshoppers and aridity and so on is overshadowed by the fact that they have locusts. Locusts are an even bigger problem, and as you know, Kazakhstan and Inner Mongolia and Australia and Africa and even Asia. These explode once in a while and then maybe disappear for decades, unlike grasshoppers, live at low levels and then come back. So that's an entirely different problem, although they really are just grasshoppers too. We all work together on these sorts of things worldwide and trade information and data, and I have worked in Africa and Asia and so on a little bit and seen that side. It's interesting to see the different perspectives, though. For example, in South Africa, grasshoppers are usually beneficial insects feeding wildlife, and they have to fight locusts like the brown locust while preserving the grasshoppers. So they have very complicated issues that we don't have, and we have to be aware of all of these possible changes in our own ecology and provide good pest control with a sound environmental health perspective.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
That was Dr. Dan Johnson, a research scientist with the Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada Research Station in Lethbridge. In January, Dan will take up his new position as the Canada Research Chair in Sustainable Grassland Ecosystems at the University of Lethbridge. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.